I'm now joined by Robert Hunter, who was the U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and U.S. representative to the Western European Union. He was a principal architect of the new NATO, leading the North Atlantic Council in obtaining airstrike decisions that halted the Bosnian War. He was also director of West European Affairs and later director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council during the Carter administration and a principal author of the Carter Doctrine for the Persian Gulf. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Robert Hunter.
Good to be with you.
I take it the person who has your old job now, it's got their work cut out for them in NATO since the president has announced that the U.S. wants to relinquish its leading role, and it doesn't appear that there's much unity within NATO over how to proceed.
Well, I guess that's where it's the most fun, when you have an impossible job as the American ambassador and trying to convince the others to do it in a way which makes eminent sense from the perspective of the United States, but doesn't necessarily make eminent sense from the point of view of all the other allies. It's even worse for my successor, Ivo Dalder, a very able person who is now the U.S. ambassador. I had 15 allies to deal with. He's got 27.
And the fundamental differences seem to be that the Turks specifically have called for a halt to air attacks on ground targets in Libya, which is the price for their ascent. And France doesn't want NATO to take the lead, I guess, and neither does Germany in particular. So let's walk through the main objections, beginning with Turkey. What's their agenda, do you think?
Well, the Turks didn't like the idea of the no-fly zone or military engagement to begin with, even though the Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, did say I guess we could swallow hard and live with a no-fly zone, but nothing else militarily. I think there are a number of things. One is the bad memories of what happened with the invasion of Iraq. Secondly, I think he's looking to his relationship with other Middle East countries, particularly Arab countries, and not wanting to be complicit in military attack that might not be contained. And third, I think the Turks have a good deal of economic interest in Libya and investment in Mr. Gaddafi, and I think even though it's a third issue, I think they want to be a little careful there.
And the French, who don't want NATO to be in the lead, they want a broader coalition, but so far, what are they thinking? It doesn't seem like any of the Arab states except Qatar seem interested in helping out here.
Well, this is part of French theology about their relationship with NATO altogether, even though a couple of years ago they did rejoin the integrated military command structure, having been out since General de Gaulle pulled them out in 1966. The French view is that, yes, if there's an attack on an allied state within Europe or elsewhere, as the United States was attacked on 9/11, NATO should do that under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty. But when it comes to other activities, unless there is some particular reason why NATO has to do it, the French would rather it was done by someone else. And in the someone else that comes out of this theology to begin with is the European Union, through the thing called, this gets elaborate now, the Common Security and Defense Policy. But, of course, CSDP, as it's called, the European Union, will not take it on because the Germans object. They don't want to see any further military action beyond what has already been sanctioned by the UN. So I think the French are being a little stiff-necked on this. After all, they can't do it. They can't really run it by themselves. The United States is the principal has the principal capacity for command and control, and the NATO apparatus is unparalleled in the world. So I think the French are being a little stiff-necked on this, looking too much at theology rather than the practical requirements of getting the job done right.
And Robert Hunter, I understand Germany's position is in some ways as a result of the Afghan involvement, which they feel has exacerbated tensions with Europe and the Muslim world. They have just they've just pulled out their Mediterranean naval force out of the NATO command.
Well, it's not just the issue with regard to relations with the Muslim or even more limited, the Arab world. It's also the very slow progress that the Germans are making in regard to the application of military power outside of circumstances which are either within Europe, like Bosnia and Kosovo, or which have a very clear relationship to the NATO treaty, as with Afghanistan. That is, a member state, the United States, was attacked, which fit under the NATO treaty. I, for one, am a little cautious about criticizing the Germans. I'm old enough to say that if you show me a German pacifist, and historically maybe that's not such a bad thing. Now, as long as they don't block what others want to do, NATO has a history of doing operations where they will take a decision to act, requires unanimity, but not all the allies will participate. For example, the Greeks, who had a very close relationship with the Serbs, in part because of the common Orthodox religion, approved NATO's actions over Bosnia and over Kosovo, but didn't become involved directly in the air attacks.
So finally, the last fly in the ointment appears to be Italy, that has the opposite point of view to the French. They're saying that unless NATO takes the lead, they would reconsider the use of their bases, which are obviously critical to this operation.
Yes, the Italians find themselves in a peculiar situation because they have had this very close relationship with Libya, with Mr. Gaddafi, as a number of allied countries have. I recall when Prime Minister Blair went rushing off to see Gaddafi at one point from the United Kingdom. But the Italians also value very much the relationship with us, the relationship with NATO. So I can understand their making that point. But again, I hope if some other arrangements worked out, the Italians won't be stiff-necked about it. But as you started off with it, my successor at NATO has got his hands full.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hunter, who was the U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton, and we're talking about how a deal may be struck, given that the president has signaled that he wants the United States out of the leading role and others to assume that role in this intervention in Libya. And why is it then, Robert Hunter, that given that the French want African Union and Arab League countries into this, in on the ground or in on the air, I guess in this case, why are the Arab countries reluctant? You got Egypt right next door with a huge air force and army with bases that could reach Libya. And is it because they're tied up dealing with the aftermath of a revolution, or what explains their truculence?
Well, I wouldn't say truculence. The Egyptians, as you say, have their hands full right now. And to expect them to go into some kind of military venture, I think, would be a bridge too far. So that doesn't trouble me at all.
But why are we the ones? I mean, you know, why not a neighbor who's directly impacted if Gaddafi takes over? And he was in the midst of doing so, Egypt will have a great refugee problem, surely, and a dangerous state next door.
They will, but given that they don't really have a government, that they're trying, they've just started to try to sort out a new constitution, which is interim, and the fact that I don't think the Egyptians would be able to do this by themselves. They'd really have to rely upon others for a whole host of things. So I can understand they're not being engaged at this point. I don't have a problem with that. Now, the French are not just talking about having others involved. We in the United States would obviously like that. It's been one of the most important things that did happen prior to the UN resolution was the Arab League did endorse a no-fly zone, as did two other relevant groups, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is the group of six countries in the Persian Gulf, are all Arabs, and another organization called the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is all the Islamic countries. They all call for a no-fly zone. Admittedly, there's a little bit of faint-heartedness now that it came so late and Gaddafi seems to be doing so well. But you could still have NATO in charge in terms of running the operation using the best command and control in the world, and have these other countries. It's been done in the past. They're called TCNs, Troop Contributing Nations. They come along, they have the same rights, even some decision-making. So that is not a barrier. In fact, when the United States led a coalition in 1991 to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, President George H.W. Bush worked very hard to get four Arab countries to sign up. They didn't do very much, but the fact that they signed up put the lie to Saddam's claim that this was, to use the words that Gaddafi is using yesterday, a new Western crusade against Islam. That is a very powerful argument for having Arabs engaged in this, but you could do that through NATO just as well as any other way.
Well, apparently next Tuesday in London, there'll be a meeting of 11 Western military contributors, Britain, France, the US, Netherlands, Canada, Norway, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, Romania, and Spain, and Qatar and the EU, and possibly Kuwait and Jordan. I take it that what the diplomats are trying to work out here is a deal that gives NATO military planners power to mastermind the operational side of this air campaign against Gaddafi, while the strategic and political decision-making rests with what the French are trying to put together, which is some kind of political contact group of the participating governments.
Well, frankly, that's the only thing that makes sense. NATO is the organization that can best manage the battle, whatever the battle happens to be. Though I must say that it's not 100% required, because these militaries are all professional. They all have a lot of experience with one another. They know how to communicate. And the chances of somebody doing something that they shouldn't, or shooting one another down, I think, is extremely remote. They talk about these things all the time. NATO would be more efficient at it, but it's not necessarily required. Now, the big problem here, particularly because the fighting started so late and Gaddafi was able to steal a march, literally and figuratively, on the people who opposed him, is what do you do now? Let us say that the use of military power as sanctioned by the UN to protect civilians doesn't blunt what Gaddafi's doing, or leads to a circumstance in which he's still in control of 80 to 90% of the country, and then Gaddafi goes around and starts killing people in his own areas of control. Then what do you do? There is no common agreement, for example, as to whether he could be tolerated to remain in power. President of the United States has said Gaddafi must go. The French have recognized the interim government, or whatever they want to call it, of the rebels. The British Prime Minister wanted Gaddafi to go, but this week he said, well, that's not what this is designed to do. At some point, you got to sort out what is it in reality, beyond this limited operation, that we are collectively striving for. And having figured that out, and that turns to a great extent on the future of Mr. Gaddafi, how do you bring about the outcome you want, and who does it? And that, as far as I can see, really has gotten nowhere in terms of planning.
So given that this appears to be a tactic in search of a strategic rationale, that the excuse may well be that it really was as it's been stated, which is in sort of an emergency humanitarian intervention, and nobody's particularly thought it through, and there are reports that there were serious divisions within the councils in the White House, where Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor apparently were very, very, and the Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs were very reluctant to use U.S. military force again in intervening in another Arab country. Second, but on the other side, apparently, three women played a role, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power, in terms of what is referred to, I guess, as being liberal interventionists.
Well, that's the kind of wonderful thing we get in Washington as things like this unfold. People start telling stories about who was one place or another. The last 24 hours, the great thing is the three women who engineered this. I don't put a lot of credence in any of that. maybe one day we'll know for sure what went on. The fact is, the president had a lot of counsel and he took his decision. I wish he had acted sooner. I think it would have been more effective. And I wish maybe some of these Europeans, beginning with the French and the British, who were so, as we say in this country, forward-leaning, I wish they had taken more of the responsibility for moving this onward. But yes, I do believe it was necessary to act in a hurry. If we'd waited another week, if peeps, whoever was doing it, waited another week, there'd probably be nothing to do. That Benghazi would have fallen, and Gaddafi would have started carrying out his pledge to cleanse his country of everybody who opposed him. So I don't have a problem with folks moving too fast. I don't think they move fast enough. Now, there was another issue in addition to the great unresolved issue of what do we do about Gaddafi, which is what happens afterwards. And this applies also in different measure to Tunisia and to Egypt. We have to recognize that for the Europeans and for us and for others, North Africa is going to be, whether you like it or not, a major charge on international action. This started out as an amazingly hopeful, some people call it fourth wave of democracy, some people talk about the second great Arab awakening, but whatever it is, it shows people reaching out within their countries to take charge of their own lives and to move in time in the direction of democracy. An extraordinarily hopeful movement. And then you have pushback by one of these leaders, this thug Gaddafi, starting to slaughter people, that's detracted attention quite properly. But we have to get back on the concern about in time. What about the future? How does one help these people who've thrown off at least two tyrants now, maybe a third in Yemen, maybe a fourth in Libya, and help these people get on with the business of living in the modern world? We have no choice, any of us, but to be involved in that.
Well, just in closing, though, that cries out for some kind of mechanism. It seems to me that since the end of the Cold War, that we have intervened on a number of occasions, largely in sending our armies off to arrest one tyrant. In the first instance, George Bush's intervention in Panama to arrest a criminal, and then to going after Saddam Hussein twice, and then and the work that you did with President Clinton over getting rid of the criminal leader Milosevic. And in the meantime, these countries get punished one way or the other, either through sanctions or through collateral damage. And the ICC seems to be able to issue indictments, as they're planning to do for Gaddafi, and they've already done that with Sudan's leader, but nothing gets done. And finally, it seems to me, with thousands of people, hundreds a day being murdered in the Congo, there's a certain selectivity to our outrage.
Yes, there is a certain selectivity. And I guess, to be honest about it, it's when these things happen closer to home, whether it's the United States in the Western Hemisphere or to the Europeans close to home there, whether it was Bosnia, Kosovo, or now in North Africa, people pay more attention, particularly with refugee flows and just a general propinquity. That does not excuse not doing things like in Rwanda, like getting rid of Mr. Mugabe in Zimbabwe, what's going on now in the Ivory Coast. I think what we're seeing now is finally a dawning of a recognition that there has to be an updating of the international community, is that the right thing, and whether it's through the UN or through some other mechanism, which is going to take more seriously what the UN enunciated a few years ago as the responsibility to protect. Now, it's a long way from here to there. One thing that I argued about myself at the time of Kosovo, where there was no UN resolution for NATO to act, because the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't permit it, but everybody agreed something had to be done. Now, we Americans argue that NATO can act within certain areas without a UN, without UN blessing, but most of the Allies, plus the Canadians, argue the opposite. the Allies in particular, because they had the experience of Nazi and then communist lawlessness. But what's not happened, there has not been an updating of international law. There hasn't been a serious effort, or at least not a successful effort, to sit down and say, you know, there are circumstances in which people do these things within their own countries that are so outrageous that there have to be both a legal and a practical means of doing something about it, and to do it in a way so you don't pick and choose, so that you don't say Rwanda is the back of beyond, or who cares about Ivory Coast, but we will care about Bosnia and Kosovo. And beginning with the efforts after the Second World War with the U.S., the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, later the Helsinki Final Act and the like, we really do need a lot of very serious thought and then action to be able to broaden this doctrine that people in their own countries have some right to be protected against the onslaught of their own leaderships.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Hunter.
I thank you very much.
And again, I was speaking with Robert Hunter, who was a U.S. ambassador to NATO under President Clinton and a U.S. representative to the Western European Union. He was a principal architect of the new NATO, leading the North Atlantic Council in obtaining airstrike decisions that halted the Bosnian War. He was also director of West European Affairs and later director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council during the Carter administration, and a principal author of the Carter Doctrine for the Persian Gulf.